Okay, this shouldn't come as a big surprise to our regulars anyway. We are on lesson four tonight in our material, covering 1 Kings 20 through chapter 22 and verse 40. So pretty much covering three chapters, or at least the better part of them here tonight. A little bit different from what we have been doing. I'm not going to put up the chart of the kings. We've got quite a bit to cover tonight, and I was afraid that if we kind of went through that again, we might come up short on our time. So we're going to dispense with that tonight. But just a very few things in the way of reminder. We are in a period of Bible history that is typically called what? The divided kingdom. Right. No longer is Israel united under one king, as they were under Saul, and then David, and then Solomon. When Rehoboam became king of Judah, the kingdom was torn in two. Of course, Rehoboam was the first king there of the kingdom of Judah. Jeroboam, the first king of the king of Israel. You've got, of course, Israel in the north. And the capital of Syria at this point is what city? Samaria. Right. Remember, they kind of started out there in Tirzah, but we saw the transition in last week's lesson to Samaria, and that will remain the case throughout their history. And then, of course, the southern kingdom of Judah has what city as its capital? Jerusalem, right. We know that at this point, Judah and Benjamin comprise the southern kingdom. But also, we saw under Rehoboam's reign, who else came and became part of the southern kingdom? All the Levites did, of course, right? They were kind of shut out by Jeroboam. He had his own priesthood, his own feast days, and all that sort of thing. And so the Levites now are part of that. But you remember there was another group of people that migrated to the southern kingdom under Rehoboam. Well, I mentioned about Judah and Benjamin, but there was another group of people, and they were described in a certain way in terms of their character. Evidently, they came from various tribes. What were they like? Right. Those who wanted to follow the Lord, right, came to the southern kingdom, which obviously that would have weakened the northern kingdom even more so, right? How many good kings have we seen in the northern kingdom of Israel? Not a single one, right? And there won't be any throughout their history. With Judah, there's going to be kind of a mix of good and bad. Now, tonight we're studying Ahab. The focus is really on King Ahab of the northern kingdom of Israel. What kind of man was he? Yeah, bad. And he was married to what kind of woman? Yeah, maybe even worse, right? And the text even talks about how she stirred him up to do evil. Not that he was unaccountable, of course. He could have resisted any or all of that, but she certainly played a major influence in his life, and we'll have some more to say about that. Now, in terms of our approach tonight, and I know at least many of you have already received the material, and it's going to be pretty much what you received. I believe the account tonight is much too rich for us to do anything other than just go through it and basically just retell what happens. There's just so many really, really good things, compelling things in the account tonight. But in terms of practical application, just some things to observe about Ahab as we go through, and I believe these are things that can be helpful for us, lessons that we can learn from him. First of all, we'll notice the two competing influences in his life. That would be Elijah, along with the other true prophets, and Jezebel. And so, basically, you had Elijah and the other prophets telling Ahab what? Yeah, what God said. Elijah and the other prophets are telling him the truth. What is Jezebel telling him? A lie. One group is trying to encourage him to do the right thing, to serve God, and the other is pulling him in the opposite direction. And, of course, we know who Ahab listened to more than the other. And really, if you think about it, that's basically what our life is all about. I mean, we've got some folks around us, right, who are trying to encourage us to do the right thing. And of course, we have our own obligation to read it directly from the Scriptures, from God. But we have people trying to encourage us to do right. But then we've got other influences trying to pull us away. And really, how things turn out for us pretty much depends on who we listen to, right? I mean, that's what it comes down to. Ahab made a terrible mistake. He listened to the wrong folks. We need to listen to the right voices. And, of course, ultimately, the voice of God. People who are trying to convince us to follow God, those are the people who should mean the most to us. But then we also want to observe how Ahab, and this language, of course, is borrowed from the passage you see, Romans 2, 4 and 5, how he despised the riches of God's goodness, forbearance, and long-suffering. I want us to think about how many opportunities Ahab was given to repent, how many demonstrations of God's power and goodness was shown to him. Last week, just to review very quickly, what powerful demonstration was Ahab given that there's only one true God and it ain't Baal? Oh, yeah, Mount Carmel, the contest, right? The prophet, you know, they had the two altars. The prophets of Baal are calling out to their God. And what does the text say? No one listened. No one paid attention. There was no voice, you know. And then, of course, contrast that with the powerful response that Elijah got when he called out to God. So, Ahab is given that. Now, how many victories tonight in our lesson does God give Ahab and his troops? Two, right? Against the Syrians, and then when the Syrians came back again, right? And what was the stated reason in each case for why God was going to deliver them into his hand? That you shall know that I am the Lord. Right. And so, certainly, ample opportunity for Ahab to know the truth. You even think about when that terrible judgment was pronounced against Ahab and his house, and Ahab humbled himself. Right. And the Lord then granted a measure of mercy to him. Right. It won't happen in your lifetime. You know, it will be delayed until you're in the days of your son. And so, just in so many ways, God showed His goodness, His mercy, His long-suffering to Ahab, and in the end, He despised the riches of that, which is the very thing that Romans 2 warned us about. And then, of course, just the way he pouted when he didn't get his way. I think there are maybe a couple of instances of this, but the one that stands out would be what? The vineyard, right? You know, he asked Naboth for the vineyard. Naboth had a good response. He cited, you know, Old Testament law. Well, he didn't give the particular passage. He just said the Lord forbid, but I think that's what he had reference to, that there were regulations against that sort of thing. And what did Ahab do? Yeah, he pouted. He went home, got in his bed, turned his face away, refused to eat anything. Yeah, just... And we'll talk some more about that later on. But my mom used to call that being in the mully grubs. And, you know, and we were strictly warned not to spend much time in the mully grubs. Daddy's way of putting it was, you better poke that bottom lip back in. And so, I mean, even as a young child, I was taught that you don't act that way, right? I mean, here's a grown man, just pouting. Of course, Jezebel will have a few things to say about that, right? Not the best person to correct someone, but and then his itching ears attitude toward the truth. Paul warned Timothy about folks like that, right? Who are not going to be so much interested in the truth; they just want somebody to scratch that itch, you know, to tell them what they want to hear. Who did Ahab surround himself with? Yeah, yes men, right? They would tell him, you know, exactly what he wanted to hear. The one man that in that instance, would tell him the truth. He says, I hate him. He never says anything good about me. But now, the interesting thing, and this is another thing that kind of perplexes one about Ahab, is He really knew, didn't he, that Micaiah was telling him the truth. I mean, after, you know, Micaiah comes out there and says, yeah, go up and take Ramoth Gilead. The Lord will deliver you. How many times have I told you? You swear to me that you'd tell the truth. And so he, deep down, he knows. And so, you know, here's a conflicted man, right? I mean, deep down, he really knows the truth. But again, those other voices just, he gave in to those. Okay, so let's go through this. Here's our first account where Samaria is attacked by Assyrians. Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, came with an alliance of 32 kings to besiege Samaria. I don't think we're told the exact size of the force, but I guess if you've got 32 kings with their troops, then it must be pretty strong. He sent messengers into the city with this demand. Your silver and gold, and this is the demand of Ahab, of course, your silver and gold, your wives and children, they are mine. And Ahab said what? Okay. All right. Ahab replied, just as you say, I and all that I have are yours. Now, I want to mention something. In some of these quotations, I've tried just to give the sense of it, right? It's not always the exact quotation. I've tried not to change the meaning in any way. Sometimes just in terms of condensing it, I put it in my own words, but hopefully haven't changed the meaning at all. Jim? I'm sorry? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Outstanding point, yes. Thank you. But Ben-Hadad grew bolder after that, right? He basically says, instead of you sending them to me, I'm coming in to get them. I'm not going to let you choose. I'm going to send some servants in here, and they're going to pick out the most prized things that they can find, and they're going to bring them out to me. Well, that didn't sit as well with Ahab, right? So he called the elders together to confer with them, and they said, do not listen or consent. Everybody seemed to be in agreement. No, we can't go that far. So Ahab sends this message to Ben-Hadad. What you said the first time, I'll do. But this, I cannot do. Can't go along with this heightened demand that you've made. So Ben-Hadad's response is, there won't be enough dirt left in Samaria to give all my men a handful. When I get through with Samaria, that's going to be the case. Now, you probably have already observed this, but there's going to be quite a few what we might call little zingers tonight, right? I mean, some pretty pointed things, you know, that that are just pretty strong in the way they're worded. And we'll observe some of those as we go through. And then Ahab, speaking of zingers, says, don't let the one who puts on his armor boast like the one who takes it off. Which, how would we say that in our own words? What's an equivalent expression that we might use? Yeah, don't count your chickens before they hatch. Yeah, that's pretty close, right? Was it one of the famous Yogi Berra statements? It ain't over till it's over. I mean, don't act like you've already got the victory in hand, right? You know, don't be like the one that's taking his armor off and he's already secured victory. I mean, don't you're just now putting it on, right? So a little back and forth, obviously, between them. And then it says, while Ben-Hadad and his fellow kings were drinking, he told his servants, get ready. In other words, prepare for battle. That's the meaning. Now, there's going to be a little bit more to add to this in just a moment, but I think we mentioned something about this in the previous study. I believe it was last week, maybe the week before. Typically, in these biblical accounts, when it talks about some people drinking, it usually is not going to end up being a very good thing, right? There's going to be trouble ahead, typically. And then certainly there's going to be for Ben-Hadad and his troops. Well, then a prophet comes to Ahab, of course, being sent by God, He says, you see this great multitude? Referring, of course, to this great army that Ben-Hadad had assembled. I will deliver it into your hand today, and you shall know that I am the Lord. We mentioned that earlier as the stated reason for that. By whom? Ahab asked. By the young leaders of the provinces, the prophet replied. Ahab said, well, who will attack first? I take that. That's the meaning of who will set the battle in order. Now, I think that's the way the New King James words it, but I think that's the sense of it. Who's going to initiate this thing? The prophet said, you will. So Ahab assembled an army with 232 officers, followed by 7,000 soldiers. They set out while Ben-Hadad and his fellow kings, according to the text, were getting drunk. So they're not just drinking a sip or two here, right? They're on their way to getting drunk. And the result, of course, was great victory for Israel, but Ben-Hadad did escape. I think it says he escaped on a horse with the cavalry. How did this battle go? What do we learn from the text about these 7,000 men that set out? What does it tell us that they did? Yeah, that ended up being a slaughter of 100,000. But that's going to be though later. And yeah, that's going to be later when they come back. But here, what happens to the army? Yeah. Right. So each one of these, it sounds like each one of these 7,000 killed one. Well, I mean, if every single one of these 7,000 is responsible for the death of another one, that's pretty intimidating, right? I mean, that pretty much indicates, you know, these guys mean business. And it was enough of a show that the Syrians fled, right? Including Ben-Hadad. He got out of there. He escaped on his horse. So the Lord delivered them into Ahab's hand, his army's hand, just like he said he would. And this would have been a great time for Ahab to have done what? To have repented, right? No more Baal. Let's go tear everything down that's associated with Baal. God. The one true God. That's the one that I will serve. All right, so this next account, and we'll just call this the Syrians come again. Prophet comes to Ahab again, says, strengthen yourself, for in the spring the king of Syria will come against you. Servants of Ben-Hadad, in kind of conferring with him, they said, well, that first time we lost because their gods are gods of the hills. If we fight against them in the plain, we'll be stronger than them. And really a lot of the cities in the northern kingdom, not all of them, but a lot of those cities were in hill country. Okay, and somehow they got the impression, well, that's the only way they could win. The servants continued, well, just giving further advice to Ben-Hadad, dismiss the kings and put captains in their place. Gather an army exactly like you had before, and we will prevail. So they've got this brilliant battle strategy. They're just sure that this is the way it's going to go down. So in the spring, Ben-Hadad mustered his forces and went up to Aphek to fight against Israel. The children of Israel gathered, equipped with provisions, but the text says their camp was like two little flocks of goats while the Syrians filled the countryside. And so, once again, they are very, very seriously outnumbered. Which, again, sets the stage for God being able to demonstrate His power, right? You would think with this description, when it's all over, no one could say, it was because of our superior force. It was because of our might and our strength, you know. Again, that just kind of sets the stage for it. The prophet comes to Ahab and says, because the Syrians think the Lord is a God of the hills and not the valleys, I will deliver this great multitude into your hand, and you shall know that I am the Lord. Now, the Israelites, including King Ahab, certainly ought to learn that lesson, but do you think anybody else might be able to learn the same lesson here? Who else is in line to learn the same lesson? Yeah, Ben-Hadad and the Syrians, right? And so, you know, I think it's in some ways similar to the plagues on Egypt. You know, certainly God wanted to demonstrate His might to His people, but He also wanted these Egyptians to know that I am the Lord. And in fact, He was more direct than Pharaoh. I mean, you know, you get through here, when I get through, you're going to know that I am the Lord. So I think the Syrians should at least be able to learn that lesson. Yeah. Sounds like it. Yeah. All right, so they encamped opposite each other for 7 days, and on the seventh day, the battle was joined. And it resulted in a very decisive victory for Israel. I think Russ just mentioned 100,000 soldiers died. I would call that pretty decisive. And as Russ also mentioned, some Syrians fled to Aphek, where a wall collapsed and killed 27,000 more. Ben-Hadad fled to an inner chamber within the city. Was this an act of God? Did God bring this about? I tend to think so. I mean, I think this is all part of delivering this army into the hand. So you got Ben-Hadad, some of his servants there with him. His servants convinced him to let them plead for mercy, saying they would go out with sackcloth around their waist and ropes on their heads. What's the symbolism there? I'm sorry? Humility. Right. We are yours, right? We are your subjects, your servants, right? And of course, this is also just kind of waving the white flag, as we would say. Servants said to Ahab, they go on out and he agrees to let them do that. So the servants go out to speak to Ahab. Ben-Hadad says, "Please let me live." To which Ahab replied, "Is he still alive? He is my brother." Now what's the significance? I've got the "he is my brother" in bold there. What was the significance of that? What were Ben-Hadad's servants listening for? I mean, they're trying to decide, right, whether to bring Ben-Hadad out. So what are they listening for? Mercy. Any sign of mercy, right? Any sign of mercy in anything that he says, right? And so they kind of seized on that, right? When he said, "He is my brother," okay. They felt pretty good then about bringing him out. So Ahab says, "Bring Ben-Hadad to me." He invited him to sit in his chariot, and they negotiated a treaty. What did the treaty involve? What were some of the conditions there? And they were all on Ben-Hadad's part, right? He was the one giving the concessions. I mean, he wasn't in a position to beg anything back on Ahab's part, was he? What did he give?
Restoration,
the
marketplace, allowing them to trade and do business.
Right, right. Yeah, the cities that my father took, I'll give those back to you. As Mar said, they could set up a marketplace there in Damascus. And as far as the significance of that, Damascus was located on what was known as the King's Highway. And that was just a major caravan route. And so if you've got a marketplace set up on the King's Highway, you can make pretty good, right? So this was a pretty good offer, right? All the way around. All right, so we'll come back to that treaty here in just a moment, or at least briefly mention it. All right, so Ben-Hadad is let go then, right, under the condition of these treaties. And that kind of leads us into this next little account here, right, where a prophet rebukes Ahab. A prophet comes to another prophet and says, "Strike me, please." In other words, wound me. Second prophet refused. And so the first prophet said, because you have not obeyed God's voice, as soon as you leave, a lion will kill you. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened, right? So, first prophet asked another to strike him. And this one did, inflicting a wound on him. You have to admit, that's a rather strange request. I don't know if he offered any... Now, we know what the first prophet was up to, right? And we'll talk some more about that in just a minute. You know, he wanted to look like a wounded soldier, right? I don't know how much he explained it. That's kind of an unusual request to go to somebody and say, hit me, wound me. Now, what we don't know, I don't think we do anyway. Somebody check me on this. I don't know if this one who did go ahead and hit him, if he observed what happened with the first one. If he did, that would be strong encouragement to go ahead. I don't know that. But anyway, the next one that he asked does comply. So the first prophet goes out disguised as one wounded in battle, waiting for Ahab to pass by. And so here's what the prophet then has to say to Ahab when they meet up. He tells Ahab about a captive he was guarding, whom he let escape. He had been warned if he went missing, it would be his life or the captive's life or pay a talent of silver. So he's just kind of setting all this up, right? I'm going to see what verdict Ahab would pronounce upon me, you know, for letting this person escape, right, that was under my charge. Ahab said, well, so shall your judgment be. You have decided it. Right? I mean, just... in your own words, the way you've described it, you know what your judgment has been. So the prophet then removed the bandage. Kind of drives the point home now, right? Makes application to what Ahab did with Ben-Hadad. Your life for his, your people for his people. And so that's what this was all about, right? And I think, you know, the thing about the captive he was guarding and so forth, I guess that's kind of like a parable. You know, it kind of reminds me of what Nathan did with David, right? But again, he makes the point here. Ahab went to his house. I mentioned this earlier, as my mom used to say, with the mully grubs. He was sullen and displeased. Now, I'm going to get a little repetitive to this, but this would have also been a good time for Ahab to have done what? To have repented. I know that's obvious, but okay. I'm just trying to say, you know, all these demonstrations, you know, that he's been given, right? But again, he decides to you know, stick his bottom lip out. All right, so now we come to this account of Naboth's vineyard. Naboth had a vineyard in Jezreel near Ahab's palace. And that's interesting because we know that the capital was actually in Samaria, so I don't know anything to make of this other than Ahab must have had another house in Jezreel. Ahab says to Naboth, give me your vineyard for a vegetable garden. I will give you a better vineyard for it or pay its value in money. Naboth replied, the Lord forbid that I should give the inheritance of my fathers to you. Did the law speak on that very thing? Yeah, absolutely. So I think Naboth's reply was certainly in order. Once again, Ahab had the mully grubs. He laid on his bed, turned away his face, and refused to eat. But now, who burst upon the scene? Well, Jezebel, right? I don't think she's going to like what she sees at all. Jezebel came in, asked him why he was acting this way. So he explained to her what happened. And she said, well, that's okay, honey. I completely understand now. Not quite, right? Jezebel said to Ahab, don't you reign over Israel? Again, I don't want to make too much of this. I don't want to change the sense of this in any way, but it's kind of like, is this the way a king should act? I mean, come on now. You know? Get up, eat some food, and cheer up. I will give you the vineyard of Naboth. And so she comes up with the most honest, legitimate plan possible, right, to take that vineyard. No, it's Involves a lot of lies and deceit, right? She wrote letters to the officials of the city and sealed them with Ahab's seal. That king's authority on this, you know, this is as if it's coming straight from the king. And the letter said, proclaim a fast and put Naboth in a place of honor. Seat two scoundrels opposite him and let them bear witness against him, saying, you have blasphemed God and the king. Then take him and stone him. And so, what did the elders of the city do? Did exactly what she asked, right? They did as they were told and then sent word to Jezebel that Naboth was dead. Jezebel then told Ahab to arise and take ownership of Naboth's vineyard. So Ahab went to take possession of it. And I would guess in their minds the matter is settled right now, right? Not exactly settled. Now, God's going to have something to say about that. God told Elijah to go to Ahab and speak to him about this matter. Say to him, God said, have you murdered and also taken possession? Where dogs licked the blood of Naboth, so shall they lick your blood. That's pretty strong, isn't it? And again, this would have been a really good time to have what? Chad.
Two quick thoughts about this. One, Jezebel, where she had come from, king took what he wanted.
Oh, yeah.
The king was idolatry. So, if this king was pouting over some religious law, it was just beyond her.
Yeah.
The other thing that stands out to me in this is, I don't know what the protocol was, the fact that she had access to the king's stamps.
Yeah. Kind of a dominant influence for sure. Yeah. Good points. So Ahab said to Elijah, after these strong words, have you found me, O my enemy? What did he call Ahab before? Yeah, troubler of Israel. Now it's just the one word, enemy. Elijah says, I have found you because you have sold yourself to do evil in God's sight. And really, we don't really have time to comment on that whole much, but think about the meaning of that. You have sold yourself to do evil. And I think that kind of helps us understand the whole process of redemption, right? Redemption kind of literally means, right, buying back. You know, we've sold ourselves. Lord's purchasing us back with His blood. And then He said, and this is kind of the full part of the judgment, I will cut off every male from your house, servant or free. Your house will be like Jeroboam's and Baasha's. We've already seen where their houses have been exterminated. Dogs will eat Jezebel's flesh by the wall of Jezreel. Dogs will eat the flesh of your family who die in the city, and birds will eat those who die in the country. It's going to be horrible for you and your house. And so Ahab's response is what? He humbled himself this time, right? If only that had kind of lasted, right? If that had endured. So God sent Elijah to tell him this calamity would not come in his days, but in the days of his son. All right, so now, let's get into this last chapter. We don't have a lot of time left. We'll have to go pretty quickly, but there's some real jewels in this. Micaiah prophesies against Ahab. 3 years passed without war between Syria and Israel. Remember the treaty? Okay, that kind of helps explain why there's a peace. Assyria, though, held the Israelite city of Ramoth-Gilead. So Ahab was talking to his servants. He said, don't you know Ramoth-Gilead is ours, and we're doing nothing to take it from Syria? As this was being discussed, Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, came to visit Ahab. Ahab asked him, will you help me take Ramoth-Gilead? And Jehoshaphat's response is what? Yeah, we're all in, right? I am as you are, my people as your people, my horses as your horses. I don't know if you could make it any clearer that we're all in than that. But then Jehoshaphat says to Ahab, well, please inquire first for the word of the Lord. before we embark on this, we need to see what the Lord has to say about it. Ahab gathered together 400 prophets, asked them if they should fight, and not surprisingly, they said, "Go up, the Lord will deliver it into the hand of the king." Jehoshaphat, thankfully, says, "Is there not a prophet of the Lord who can inquire of him?" What does that tell us about these other 400 prophets? Yeah, and I would think these were probably prophets of Baal, right? I would guess so. And let's just say if they were endeavoring to be prophets of the Lord, they weren't doing a very good job of it. Okay, we can at least say that. Ahab says, "Well, yes, one man, Micaiah, but I hate him because he never prophesies anything good about me. Always bad." Jehoshaphat said what? "Don't say such a thing," right? That got all over him, evidently. And it should have, you know. I mean, for a king to say something, for anybody to say something like that, it really bothered him. Ahab told an officer to bring Micaiah quickly. Meanwhile, the other prophets prophesied before the two kings, all saying they should fight. One prophet named Zedekiah, he kind of makes a show out of it, doesn't he? He said he came out with a set of iron horns and claiming to speak for the Lord said, "With these," that is, "with these iron horns, you shall gore the Syrians until they are destroyed." Meanwhile, the messenger sent to get Micaiah tried to coach him, right, on what to say. What was the coaching? How did he coach him up? Yeah, the other guys, they've been saying some very encouraging things, you know, and so you need to just kind of, you know, fall in line with that, say encouraging things. And Micaiah said, "As the Lord lives, whatever he says, that I will speak." And really, that sounds a whole lot like the words of Jesus in regard to his diligence in teaching only what the Father gave him to teach. Ahab asked Micaiah, "Should we fight or not?" Now, if we didn't know anything about this account before, if this was our first time reading it, we might think he might just go ahead and say, no, that's not the thing to do. But kind of sets the whole thing up, right? Micaiah said, "Go up and prosper. The Lord will deliver it into your hand." I can't say for sure, but I really believe one of the reasons why he said it this way is to elicit this response. Ahab said, "How many times do I have to make you swear to tell me nothing but the truth?" Whether that was intended or not, it draws out Ahab's true feelings about the matter, right? He knows that Micaiah is really telling the truth.
We don't know his facial expression.
Yeah. Exactly.
And after he had made such a bold declaration that he would only speak what the Lord told him to speak.
Right. Yeah, right, yeah. Good point, especially in light of what he had said earlier. Micaiah said, "I saw all Israel scattered on the hills like sheep. The Lord says for them to go home because they have no master." The master, of course, would be King Ahab, right? Well, Ahab said to Jehoshaphat, "I told you he wouldn't have anything good to say. Didn't I warn you?" Micaiah continued, said, "I saw the Lord sitting on his throne with the host of heaven gathered around him. The Lord said, who will lure Ahab into going against Ramoth-Gilead that he might die there?" One spirit said, "Well, I will persuade him." The Lord said, "In what way?" He replied, "I will be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets." The Lord said, "You shall persuade him and prevail. Go do it." I know we've talked about this some before, but let us never forget that what's being played out here on the earth is not the only thing that's going on, right? There's action behind the scenes that we don't have the privilege of seeing, but we do have the privilege of seeing it here. We know what's going on behind the scenes. Look! Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And really all that's been said up to this point, I think they should have already gotten the point, but just in case, you know, Micaiah drives the point home. He says, look, the Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these prophets, and the Lord has declared disaster against you. One of the false prophets, Zedekiah, struck Micaiah on the cheek and said, which way did the Spirit of the Lord go from me to speak to you? And boy, you got to love Micaiah's response. You'll see on the day when you go into an inner chamber to hide. Ahab said, take Micaiah to Ammon, the governor, and Joash, the king's son, and put him in prison. Feed him with bread and water until I come back in peace. Micaiah had a pretty good response to that. He said, if you return in peace, the Lord has not spoken by me. And he didn't want just Ahab to hear this. He says, listen up, all you people. You need to learn something from this. All right, so let's quickly go through this last part where Ahab is killed. Ahab and Jehoshaphat both went up to Ramoth-Gilead. Ahab told Jehoshaphat, I'll disguise myself, but you wear your robes. And I think we know the reason for that. King of Syria said to his troops, though, fight with neither small nor great, but only with the king of Israel, only with Ahab. When the captain saw Jehoshaphat, they thought he was Ahab. Jehoshaphat, I guess you'd say he did the prudent thing here, right? He cried out. In some way or another, he let them know, you know, hey, I'm not the one. So they turned away from him. A random arrow. Imagine that. Random arrow struck and wounded Ahab. And imagine, just exactly in the right place, right? Between the joints of his armor. And he told his driver to remove him from the battle. The battle continued with Ahab propped up in his chariot. The blood from his wound ran down to the floor of the chariot, and that evening he died. A call to end the battle was issued at sunset. Every man to his own city. Because, remember the words of Micaiah? Because who's dead? Your master is dead. All you sheep, you know, return to your homes. Ahab was brought to Samaria and buried. They washed his chariot by the pool of Samaria, the very place where prostitutes bathed. The dogs licked up his blood, according to the word of the Lord. And then, of course, Ahab's son, Ahaziah, reigned in his place. And we'll talk some more about that. All right, go ahead, Lamar. I'll shut up, but y'all can.